Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thank you for listening in. I am your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Please stay with us for the next hour here on Local Talk, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. A variety of community topics this morning. During the coming hour, we'll hear from a former prosecuting attorney who has turned his attention to promoting victim-offender dialogue to reduce crime. Also, bike sharing is coming to Ames, and we'll get updates on that. And Leanne Harder, Story County Outreach Manager, will join us in the second half of the hour with a report from the Story County Supervisor's Office. First, a quick look at the weather. Mostly sunny today with a high near 81. Tomorrow, partly sunny with highs near 86. Tuesday night, 20% chance of rain and thunderstorms. Wednesday, 30% chances of rain and thunderstorms. And Thursday night and Friday, 50% chance of rain and thunderstorms are predicted. But that should diminish overnight on Friday. Saturday and Sunday, sunny days, clear skies are expected with highs near 80 during the days, which is great news for KHOI since we'll be holding a block party on Saturday. Why is that? Well, it's because KHOI is celebrating its fourth birthday. Please come to celebrate with us on Saturday at KHOI 410 Douglas Avenue from 11 a.m. until 9 p.m. The street will be blocked off, and there will be 3-on-3 basketball tournaments, which you can join if you have a team or just watch. Inside KHOI, there'll be a book sale. There'll be music outside. Willie's barbecue truck will be there, and we'll have homemade blueberry pies for sale by the slice. All proceeds go to support your community radio station. The book sale will continue through Sunday, so if you can't make it on Saturday, come on down on Sunday. We'd love to sell you a book and hear you say happy birthday. And if you brought us books, it's been great. Thank you. And yes, you can still bring your books to the station this week for the book sale. Restorative justice is an innovative approach to reducing crime by offering both victims and offenders a unique form of closure. This is being pioneered by an attorney in Des Moines named Fred Van Loo, who used to be a prosecuting attorney. KHOI reporter Kay Puttock spoke with him on the phone. He's currently in Maine, where he spends his summers, to find out more about the work he's doing. He told Kay about this thoughtful approach to addressing crime. Let's listen.
Fred Van Loo, an attorney interested in restorative justice. There's something wrong with the whole way we think about justice and crime and punishment.
I am an attorney, but I was a prosecuting attorney for 25 years. And before I found out about this thing called restorative justice, I was working in the traditional system. What I began to recognize was that while they thought they wanted a harsh punishment as a result of what had happened to them, many victims would find that after that harsh punishment was imposed, that there was still something missing. But they didn't know how to articulate that. They didn't know what it was. And in 1991, a minister friend wrote me a letter and said, Fred, you've got to find out about this thing called restorative justice. And as I began to look into it and then started doing victim-offender dialogue, began to see what the real needs were of victims been harmed and the needs of offenders, too, to apologize, to express remorse, and not to minimize, which is what most people thought. It's understandable that people, particularly people in the victim field, victim advocates would think, I have this victim, she's been hurt deeply, she continues to hurt, and yet this person will sit across from her and not take that seriously, not take what's said seriously.
In other words, just by being face-to-face with the victim, the presence and the things they might say might make the victim feel victimized again.
Absolutely.
Yes,
that's right,
okay.
Right. We get hurt when we're not heard or seen, when what we say is not taken face value or fully. But that's the sort of the beauty, the magic of the process. If correctly facilitated, managed, does create a space where there is the opportunity for vulnerability.
On
both sides, absolutely. Mm-hmm. On both sides. And so the normal way we handle criminal cases doesn't allow this kind of very human, very intimate interaction.
What you seem to be talking about is when the person has already been convicted, and then you have the dialogue to help make the victim feel better and perhaps help the offender in some way. But it can also happen before sentencing. I think that's partly why people think, you know, they're getting off too lightly if you have this.
First of all, should we talk primarily about serious cases?
And like murder and rape, say.
It is rare that because an offender agrees to participate in a dialogue, that that changes in a radical way the trajectory of the case. So you don't have a murderer meeting with somebody and then not being sentenced and not going to prison. Now, what you will see is that the sentence may be reduced some.
And the victim will feel happy about that.
Not only feel happy, but request that. We'll say, you know what, this man should not die in prison. I've met with him. We bridged the gap. And I don't think life in prison is warranted based on my experience with this person. Restorative justice is not a slap on the wrist. In fact, restorative justice did not come into existence as an alternative sentencing approach. It came into existence because it meets needs. It shifts the focus from punishment to repair. That's where the emphasis needs to be. And the emphasis needs to be on who was hurt, how were they hurt, who's responsible for that hurt. What does it mean to be responsible or accountable? So there is accountability, but punishment isn't the focus for punishment's sake. Accountability is a focus, but not punishment.
For lesser offenses, for lesser property offenses, they could make restitution in some way and might want to do that.
Oh, absolutely.
Relatively recently in the news, some of the women that were involved in the Charles Manson so-called family came up for parole, and relatives of the victim came forward and said, no, you know, I've lost my loved one. And this often happens.
I think it's human nature. You know, we want somebody to hurt. I've seen it on both sides. I've seen women who were raped, given an opportunity by the judge at sentencing to meet with the man, the perpetrator, before being sent to prison. And the victim says, absolutely not. Why would I want to do that? And 4 or 5 years later, call comes. You know what? I remember at the sentencing, judge said I could meet with him. I need to meet with him. I've been through therapy, been through counseling, and it's not enough. I need to sit across the table from him and tell him how my life was changed by what happened that night. And in my experience, anyway, that's where healing can come from, that place of I need the person who harmed me to know about it. No, not just in a letter, not me testifying at a sentencing hearing, but I need to sit across from him. And then the magic of it is she tells her story, okay? Whether it's parents of someone murdered or a woman who's been raped or a family that's been burglarized, and they tell their story with all of the accompanying emotion. That story then gets ingested, in a sense, by the offender, and they have an epiphany, they have an awakening. And then the victim sees that his or her words were meaningful, brought about a visible change in the person sitting across the table. So it's like this three-step process, the telling of the story, the reception of the story, the recognition that the story has been received and honored. That you don't tell people this is going to happen, but it is what happens. Where does that happen anywhere else in our society?
And there are skilled facilitators to help this process, because as you point out, in ordinary human relations, we're all aware of people apologizing to us, and it doesn't really feel like an apology.
Right.
It feels more like, oh, stop talking about it. Oh, I don't want to hear about it. They might say, oh, I'm sorry about that, but it doesn't feel right. So obviously needs to be some expert guidance here to make the process go.
It's not for every mediator, because the typical mediator doesn't drill down to this deep level. It tends to be agreement driven. And it may well be that an agreement happens, but in the mind of the facilitator, the agreement is secondary. What needs to happen, you need to create this space for the cathartic moment. In fact, there are people that are excellent facilitators in this work who otherwise don't do mediation work.
Uh-huh.
You can make the argument that traditional mediation can actually be an impediment to doing this kind of work, you know.
Because it's too much driven towards getting both sides to, at least on paper, say that they've come to an agreement.
Right. I used to facilitate like major embezzlement, and the CEO would come in, or the accountant, or the CFO, and they'd be loaded for bear. they would have the books, the ledgers, you know. I don't know what they bring in now, but back then it was paper, and they would want an agreement. This much was taken, and you're going to pay every cent back, and you're going to pay it back at this rate. But if you stay with it, and if you listen for those little things that they might say that suggest what's really happened here, you know, money's an issue. What's really happening here is betrayal, you know, and that's where you want to be with these people. You look for that. It's the matter that, you know, I trusted you. I moved you up. I trusted you with my employees that you would pay their taxes on time. Despite all that trust, you did this thing to me. It hurts. But if you gloss over that, if you skip over that piece of it, you've not done the work that needs to be done.
It goes right to the basis of being human and living in human society. We have to trust one another.
Yes, it is so fundamental.
Would you like to talk more about the process itself?
At one level, it's simple. So I'm doing a training tomorrow for juvenile court officers. And I had a conversation this morning with the director of corrections for this part of the state. And he said, well, can you give them a checklist so that they know how to do this? In fact, you don't want that checklist either in your head or on paper. It's really about deep listening, absolute deep listening. And somehow, with your presence, creating a space. The preparation really begins before you bring everybody together so that at least there's some trust of you as a facilitator.
Right.
First, you have to physically have a safe space. The creation of that safe space actually begins before the meeting. You have to have individual conversations with people so that they have some sense as to what they can expect and what the value might be for them, so that they know that there's probably not much in the way of limitations that would be imposed on them in terms of what they can say or not say or emotions that they can express. You have to begin to earn that trust. So you do that under the guise of letting them know about the process, what they expect, talk about confidentiality, the value of this meeting, what it might be for them, and even talking to them about what we've learned, you know, what the research shows, you know, in a very gentle way, not giving them a lot of data, but that this isn't just something that just landed on the earth. You know, we've been doing this for a long time, and we've learned a lot, and we've learned about the value. So that's necessary, and it may take a year to get ready, and it should. I'm working on a case in which a young boy, just before he turned 18 on Halloween 2 years ago, was riding with two friends. They were sober, but he was speeding, hit a curb, and he killed his two best friends.
And the person that was driving survived, and the two friends were killed?
Yes. Terrible. Good student, responsible, never done anything wrong before. But he got caught up in the joyriding with two friends on Halloween evening. We're 4 months into the preparation of that and not ready to do it yet. You can imagine the ripple effect of the families, the parents that lost a child, siblings, aunts and uncles, neighbors, people at school. There's a lot to be sensitive about.
Right. So, you've written a book called The Justice Diary about restorative justice. That title makes it sound as if it's describing a lot of actual cases.
It actually is. I started driving around pretty much every month in my old pickup truck and going into courthouses, talking to police, talking to people on the street, going to community meetings and that kind of thing.
Could you tell us about one or two of the more memorable experiences you've had doing this work?
So this was a case that I handled as a prosecutor in which a 16-year-old boy is walking home from high school. He gets jumped by three boys. They're on the ground, and one boy has a knife. In the altercation, his spleen is lacerated. And he's left in a pool of blood to die. But for a woman walking her dog who happened to see this on a side street and called the police. Rushed to the hospital in surgery for eight hours. And as the surgeon told the parents later, but for the width of a quarter, your son would be dead. So the case came to me because I was a supervising prosecutor and I looked at it and thought, is there any way to do a restorative process here? A few days after that, as I was beginning to think about that, I got a call from the attorney for one of the boys and said, Fred, can we do something different here? These boys, they're looking at going to prison, okay, even though they were juveniles. And if they got moved to adult court, they would go to prison for sure because it was mandatory. So we began the conversations, the parents and the boy. And it took about 3 months. And finally they said, we need to do this. Not like they didn't say, we want to help these boys. We need to do this. We need to let them know what happened, what they did to our family.
Right.
But early on, I would say that they absolutely wanted the boys to go to prison. They wanted the boys to lose their youth, is what they told me. We want them to lose their youth just as they took my son's youth from him. So, no, I won't forget, and many of these I won't forget, but this one I won't forget. We met in an evening at the law school in a very, very private, safe place. And the parents tell the story of what it was like to get the call and then to go to the hospital and wait for hours, not knowing if their son would live or not, and not knowing when the surgery would end. And then the long convalescence in the hospital, So they tell all of this in a very, as you can imagine, a very heartfelt way. And the boys don't respond. It's not that they're hardened, but they don't have words, and they're not skilled in this kind of conversation. And then the boy talks, the 16-year-old, and he said, you know, baseball has been my whole life, and every year I look forward to it. And he said, I particularly look forward to this year because this is going to be my last year of baseball. I had gained 20 pounds, you know, I grew a couple of inches, and I was looking forward to hitting a home run for the very first time. And he's telling them this, and he tells the boys, you stole baseball from me. He mm-hmm. says, let me tell you what it's like to sit on the bench the entire season, keeping score when I could have been playing, and while my teammates went on to win the league championship. And the boys start to cry. And you just sit with that. I don't know, for how long? 5 minutes is a long time. But you just sit with that. You let that. You don't move on from that. And they understood for the first time what they had done. And whether it's anger, right, or fear, I call it sitting in the muck. You have to be comfortable right. and not feel like you've got to do something, not feel like you've got to fix it, that you've got to turn the tears off, that you've got to change the conversation, that you've got to move on to another topic. It's a movement on the local level that is really having some impact, really opening people up, and it's exciting. I think when it comes to justice, you've got to do it one courthouse at a time, you know, one police department at a time, one school at a time.
This can be used not just for crimes, but for conflicts in school between teachers and students. This is another aspect of the work that you do. I've been talking to Fred Van Loo, who's an attorney working in Maine and in Iowa on restorative justice, a whole new way of thinking about justice.
I'm really pleased that I sense that you have a feel for its value. And that's really nice to know that some people in the media are that way, you mm-hmm. know. Because it really takes a lot more than sound bites to have people begin to get some grasp of it, you know. But I appreciate you taking the time to do that.
We are living neath the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side. I am alone, I am searching, hungering for answers in my time. I am balanced at the brink of wisdom. I'm impatient to receive a sign. I move forward with my senses open. Imperfection can be my crime. In humility I will listen. We're all swimming to the other side. We are living in the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side. On this journey through thoughts and feelings, binding intuition, my head, my heart.
You're listening to Local Talk on Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. That was Swimming to the Other Side by Emma's Revolution. And before that, you heard an interview with Fred Van Loo, a Des Moines resident who is a former attorney who practices what is called restorative justice. He was speaking with Kay Puttock, and if you're interested in speaking him with about mediation issues or to have him speak to a group about the work they're doing in Des Moines, he is receptive to hearing from you. He can be reached at fvlmediation@gmail.com. That's fvlmediation@gmail.com. And as always, we'll post that information on the homepage of our website, khoifm.org. Julie Weeks is here and Dan DeGeest, and they have come to speak to you about bicycles. Lots of stuff going on regarding bicycles in Ames. Sounds like new bike share programs are springing up for people to use who want to bike around town but might not have their own bike. So now, as I understand it, both Julie Weeks, who is the director of the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, and Dandy Geest, who's with the Ames Bicycle Coalition, went on a trip organized by the Ames Chamber of Commerce to Manhattan, Kansas, which has a bike share program. Dan and Julie, could you tell us what happened? Julie, you want to, or Dan, do you want to go first?
Oh, sure. Good morning.
Good morning.
So a group of us, this was back in May, it was organized by the Ames Chamber, and I'd say about 40 of us got onto a charter bus to go down to Manhattan, Kansas for one full day and an overnight, and then part of the following day. And we did a number of different tours, and we met with city officials from Manhattan, Kansas. We took a tour of K-State, and then we had some free time as well to just kind of check out the city. And the idea was to kind of compare some of the programs and some of the things that are happening in Manhattan and kind of compare that with Ames, Iowa. They're very similar in terms of population, you know, both university towns and so forth. So, we hopped on the bus and we headed down early morning. And
so was this open to anybody who wanted to go, or was this a committee, or who?
I believe it was open to anybody who wanted to go. The invitation was passed along to me from my one of my coworkers, Dave Tucker, who's part of the Ames Chamber, as a former city council candidate and, you know, being part of the Ames Bicycle Coalition and various different things that I'm doing in the community. I was very interested to go down and check out to see kind of what Manhattan is doing in terms of workforce development and whatnot, compare that to what we're doing out at Workiva, and just kind of understand how they're able to attract and retain employees and what kind of cool things they're doing. And just hoping to bring back some ideas that we could implement here in Ames. And I think that was sort of everybody's goal.
And Julie, why did you go?
Well, the opportunity, again, to go to a very similar community and see what they did on the visitor side. I don't often get to be a visitor, you know, when you come to Ames.
You're the host.
We're always hosting, you know, everybody else. So it was great to be able to go there and actually be hosted and check out their hotels, check out the services they had available, check out how the community interacted with the hospitality industry, and of course, the community and university relations there and how they compare to Ames and, you know, what we're doing that are similar. You know, there are a lot of times we found out that we were actually, you know, doing things which in some ways were better, you know, for Ames and different. But they did have some great ideas for us to come back with, and it was fun to try to implement some of those.
What was an example of something that we're doing better?
I think we have a stronger university-community relationship. Their university individuals were great. They did a nice tour of campus, but I never felt, I mean, you either felt like you were at K-State or you were in, you know.
And they weren't as integrated.
I think from that standpoint. And, you know, also when we met with some of their city officials, I think, you know, it was just a little different vibe in that sense, too.
Did Manhattan, Kansas invite the chamber, or how were they picked?
I think the chamber, you know, put together this. A lot of cities do this. We've been contacted before, and the chamber has hosted other communities that have come here and done the same thing. So this is not uncommon for cities to do, is to take these trips
and visit each other
To just get a sense on how other communities do things. And so Manhattan was chosen, again, because of the size, the proximity. We could get there on a bus in a day and back. It's a land-grant institution with K-State, much like Iowa State. So the similarities were very strong from that
standpoint. And do they have a Convention and Visitors Bureau?
They do have a Convention and Visitors Bureau. In fact, I know their CVB director, met her years ago at a national conference. And they are part of the Cities of the Big 12. We also have a CVB relationship with other cities of the Big 12 Conference. So.
And Dan, the Ames Bicycle Coalition is a coalition of private citizens, right?
Correct.
Did Manhattan, Kansas have something similar to that as well?
Not that I'm aware of. I didn't hear of anything like that. Of course, with my background with bicycling around Ames and the Ames Bicycle Coalition, I was definitely had an eye out for what was going on in Manhattan, Kansas from a bicycling perspective. I think we did see a few things there that we're not quite doing in Ames yet that, were some good takeaways. And of course, we're going to be talking about the sort of the free bikes and the bike share kind of concepts here, which was something that we did encounter down in Manhattan.
So was the trip to Manhattan expressly about bike shares, or was it just a general visit to see how they do things?
Oh, it was a general, much more general than that. We looked at everything from some of the industry to how they were developing their downtown area to development of their campus town area. So it was very broad, and the bicycle program just happened to be one that was glaringly obvious, I think, because they had one where they had 100 bicycles just sitting around town in racks, and you could just walk up, take it, and ride it to the next rack or ride it wherever you wanted to, bring it back. And it was a no-charge bicycle program, which was different than anything I'd ever seen. I mean, you go to Chicago, you go to Kansas City, and they have a pay-for on
right.
a commercial
system.
Yeah,
New York, too. Okay, so one of the things that came to the surface was this bike share program, which is what you're here today to talk about. And both of you came away with a slightly different takeaway in terms of how that got manifested here in Ames. It's kind of an idea that's been slowly bubbling to the surface anyway in Ames. So, Julie, tell us about what the Convention and Visitors Bureau ended up doing.
Well, because of Convention and Visitors Bureau and some of the guests like Dan, they actually rode the bicycles when we were in Manhattan. We came back and looked at the opportunity to provide bicycles for our guests. Our overnight guests were in Ames. Most of our Ames hotels are really not within walking distance of a lot of other attractions and restaurants, that type of thing. But they are easily accessible to some bike paths, some great trails in Ames, and they could get around Ames that way. Back in the – when I actually first came to Ames, back in the late 70s, you know, we used to host orchestras and stuff, and people would bring their bicycles to the hotels.
That's right.
To have let them ride them.
Private citizens.
Yeah,
would.
Private yeah. citizens
that
would just bring
with,
them in.
With the New York Symphony.
Absolutely, with IOFA and the New York Symphony at the Ramada
that.
Inn, yes, on University Boulevard.
That's right.
And I was part of that, believe it or not, back in the 70s, and we'd never been able to do it
so
again.
So was I.
And we saw that happen in Manhattan, so we brought it back here, and we talked to the hoteliers, and we had several that were interested, and they had some of them had bicycles available, but not really on a regular and consistent basis. So we were able to work with Cycle Force Group, a local Ames company, and we purchased 30 bicycles, and they'll be spread between 5 different hotels as a trial program this fall. It started last week. We'll deliver the rest of them this week, and hotel guests are able to check out a bicycle at the front desk, ride it wherever they want, bring it back, lock it back up, and just use them while they're here in Ames.
So it's a free service for
visitors. It is a free service for visitors.
Overnight
guests. And we do have some at the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau office, which anybody can stop by and check out.
Oh, so you do have some for local people as well?
Yes. Limited availability, but yes, there are some.
Okay, and are these bikes in, are they on the road?
We delivered some last week, and Dan told me this morning that I saw some over the saw one over the weekend downtown. So we did get some delivered last week, and the rest will be delivered this week. You know, great timing with students coming back, parents bringing them back in the fall time frame. So they'll be out available from now until the first snowfall, or roughly, you know, in the wintertime we'll store them, or the weekend after Thanksgiving, and then we will store them and evaluate the program and see what we come up with next spring.
So how many bikes are there going
to
be?
We have 30 to start with.
And how many hotels?
Five hotels. The Quality Inn out on 13th Street, Gateway Center, the Best Western Plus across from that, and the Grand Stay, and then the American and the Country Inn are going to share some because they're right there located together.
Okay, so another thing that makes Ames a destination.
We hope so. You know, we get a lot of cyclists in Ames, and the hotels said that, you know, they got a lot of people asking for them
bicycles
at the desk, where they could rent them or where they could get to them. So we just made it a little more convenient for them.
That's very nice. All right, Dan, what did you take away from Kansas?
In terms of the bike, bike share program?
Yes, in terms of the bike share.
Well, I thought it was a great idea, first of all. We were staying at a hotel that was kind of in between. It was pretty close to Aggieville, which is their version of their campus town. and then their downtown area is approximately 1 or 2 miles from there. But it was really great. You know, we came in on the charter bus, so clearly we didn't have any transportation. So options are taxis, Uber, walking, and that sort of thing. So it was really great that the hotel right outside had this rack with bikes in it. I think they call it the Green Apple Bike Share, if I remember correctly. And if there was a bike in the rack, you were free to take it and ride to where you wanted to go. All they really requested is that you they just wanted you to let them know, because they were trying to just track how much usage they would get. So if you were so inclined, you could text the number and say, I used the bike for this many miles or this much time. And that's just going to help them to perpetuate the project with some statistics. But it was great because it was, like I said, it was May. It was wonderful weather. Very convenient to just hop on one of these bikes and bike to wherever you wanted to go. We took them to dinner. We took them out afterwards. And
it's kind of a sense of freedom, right?
Yeah, it really was.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, to be fair, it was a little bit of a challenge, because initially there was only one bike in the bike rack by the hotel, and there were several of us that wanted to have bikes. And so it took a little while. We did some walking first, and then we came back and like, oh, now there's another bike in the rack. And it just, you know, it was kind of just a gamble. It doesn't have that built-in, you know, for sure convenience
right.
that it's a bike share. It's going to be there because you're paying or you have to check it out and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of a just sort of unknown to it. That actually,
and obviously there's a demand.
Right. Kind of makes it fun as well. So I brought this back. We talked about it on the bus on the way back, and everybody was kind of excited about it. And I was talking with some of my friends about this kind of a concept. And you've had Lindsay and Elliot on the program before, so we've been working on this grain mill over in West Ames called Reliable Street. And, you know, it's kind of a community art-focused sort of thing that we're trying to do. And I was telling them about this bike share idea, and Lindsay's like, well, I've always wanted to have, you know, free bikes available that people could just take and ride around town as well. And I said, well, why don't we just try it? Why don't we do it? So our approach was is a little bit different. Our approach is, well, what can we do with basically no budget and no money? And so what we're trying to do is, there literally are bikes all over Ames. When the students clear out, there's all kinds of bikes left behind. You can always find bikes at like the ISU surplus sale. There's always people that have bikes that they don't know what to do with them anymore. They've had kids that have outgrown them, or for whatever reason, there's a lot of bikes out there. So we'd like, our idea was, could we get these bikes and fix them up into riding condition, and let's just put them out. Initially, we'll start with having them out near Reliable Street and just let people take them and ride them and see what happens. And so that's kind of how our program got started, and we're calling them zebra bikes. So we had to have some way of kind of identifying them, and we came up with this idea of painting them with black and white stripes, that they're very unique. They stand out, and if you see one going down the street, you would understand that it's a zebra bike. And if you found it left by the somewhere, people would know where it goes. So that's kind of what we're trying to do.
Okay.
Low budget to no budget, and free to take, free to use.
And again, where did the bikes come from?
The bikes have been coming from all over. We've had people, we had a donation day a couple weeks ago, and we invited people to just drop off bikes at Reliable Street. I had one, somebody else had one, so they're just kind of coming from all over.
So how big is the fleet?
We have about 25 bikes right now, but
it's respectable.
You know, we're also working on them, so I've got experience working on bikes. Lindsay's an artist, and she's can paint them in no time, does a great job. They look really professional, actually, with just spray paint. We have a few other friends that know how to work on bikes as well, so we're slowly getting them up and running. It might take combining two bikes. We might get one bike that has something broken and another bike that has a different part broken, and we're able to put the bikes together. So they're all different. They're all unique. They're all a little bit unconventional. We've been doing some fun things. I brought one in to kind of show you an example of what we've been doing. We have some that have, you know, the big handlebars like off of a kid's bike, and just having some fun with it. So it gives us the freedom to do a little bit more fun type stuff.
Mm-hmm. And are they already being used?
Yes and no. So we do have a few that have gotten out of the herd, is what we call it. So just some friends, we've ridden them around, and then we've had a couple that have been left at a house, and then somebody took it. And so you might see a couple of them going around town, but we haven't really officially release them yet. We're trying to get – we want to get up to like 20 or 25 total bikes before we really start promoting it a lot.
So the deal with them is that you get them out at Reliable Street and then you ride them around and then you bring them back to Reliable Street or
Correct.
You leave them
– uh-huh. That's the concept so far. We have talked about the idea of possibly it's almost kind of like the little library model where maybe we could find a few other places where we could have a station.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the idea being just like the ones in Manhattan, Kansas, the sort of understood way it works is if it's in the bike rack, then it's not in use. It's free to take and ride around town. If for example, it was, you know, parked in front of the coffee shop or whatever, you would have the assumption that somebody's using it and you don't mm-hmm. want to hop on it and just take it. And now that person is.
So you would only take it from the station.
Right. And
okay.
So the little library model is probably a pretty good analogy of what we would uh-huh. like to do eventually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what is the projected starting date for the fleet to hit the street?
We're hoping later this month to have a little release party over at Reliable Street. And, you know, part of what we're trying to do too is just remind people of the joy of riding a bicycle mm-hmm. and make the bikes fun. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be that you want to go from point A to B. Maybe you just want to
go for a joyride,
hop on the bike and just, you know, mm-hmm. be a kid again and just joyride around town and have some fun.
Okay. Remind us again where Reliable Street is so that.
Sure. Reliable Street is it's 4625 Reliable Street, and it is the former Doughboy Industries grain mill and warehouse, and it's so West Ames, just off of North Dakota, and it's
kind of can't miss it.
You kind of can't miss it. It's pretty much probably the tallest structure in the skyline over there.
Right.
Yeah.
So go to Ontario Road and North Dakota and look for the really big grain elevator.
Right.
And that's it.
And then look for the black and white zebra bikes.
Thank you. I'm speaking with Dan DeGeese from the Ames Bicycle Coalition and Reliable Street.
Correct.
New cultural center that's going up on the west end of town. And talking about the zebra bikes, which are going to hit the street maybe later this month or sometime
hopefully
by fall.
About time students start coming back, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. A free bike share program. And Julie Weeks from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau. And these are free bikes for mostly visitors that come to Ames who are staying at hotels.
And that would be the easiest to access them. Yep.
Uh-huh. Okay. Are you both happy with your projects?
You know, it took us a while to get it, but yeah, we're excited about it. We've already had, like, some people use them. The hotels are excited about them. The staff was actually excited. We foot delivered them. We drove them to the hotels. The mm-hmm. staff actually did it. So they had fun with them, and we'll have them available for staff and others out at the Aspen Business Park to ride around. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the same feeling. It's just fun to ride a bicycle.
It's fun to ride a bicycle.
And mm-hmm. we hope people enjoy that.
The feeling of freedom. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And Dan, you happy so far?
Oh, yeah. We're having a blast. it's really fun to work on them I'm excited for both programs. I think they're both complementary. You know, this clearly isn't some kind of competition thing about which bicycle program is the best.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned earlier, there is another initiative still to try and get probably an official type of bike.
Through Iowa State.
Correct.
So, yeah.
So these are all great. They all work together. And, mm-hmm. You know, the more bikes on the street, the better, I think.
Yeah, and so, from what you said about Manhattan, Kansas, there's probably going to be a demand, and so it's good to have options.
Yep.
We're definitely going to have to check back with all of you mm-hmm. in a few months to see what kind of stories you have. You're going to have some good stories to tell.
I hope they're good ones.
Thank you so much for coming by and talking about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm just mad about saffron. Well, saffron's mad about me. I'm just mad about saffron. She's just mad about me. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow. About 14, 14's mad about me. I'm just mad about 14. She's just mad about me. They call me mellow yellow. They call me mellow yellow. Quite rightly, they call.
Listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. Around this time of every month, we check in with the Story County Board of Supervisors, and Leanne Harder, Story County Outreach and Special Projects Manager, is here. Welcome back, Leanne.
Good morning.
So what news do you have from the county?
Well, I'm going to start, first of all, with a call out to those veterans that participated in the Freedom Flights that Story County has done. We had Freedom Flights in 2002, or 2012, 13, 14, and 15. And Treasurer Renee Tweet and our VA Director Bart McLean would like to invite them all to the Lincoln Highway Day Parade at the end of the month in Nevada. They're asked to wear their yellow shirts and their hat, and they can join in and ride on the parade.
And what day is that?
It's the 26th and 27th, last weekend in August.
So they just should just show up in Nevada?
I think so. And I will get you more information because that was information I didn't get.
Okay.
I know they have a special location that they want them to meet. But the best course of action, any veterans that did participate, get a hold of Renee Tweet or Brett McLean, and they can give the details.
And where can they get hold of them?
They can call the county number at 382-7200 or email either one of them.
Okay. Say that phone number again.
515-382-7200.
Okay.
And then another thing we have happening every August, July and August, the Board of Supervisors accepts applications for the urban renewal area. And that is just quite simply our TIF district, tax increment financing. The county has TIFed, or tax increment financing, all the wind turbines in Story County. And the revenue from those wind turbines go towards some micro projects throughout Story County.
Mm-hmm.
And so last week and this week at the board meeting, which is every Tuesday morning, the Board of Supervisors is hearing applications from five different cities to get grant funding. And so the four cities that presented last week were Collins, Cambridge, Huxley, and Story City. And then tomorrow the board will hear from the city of Slater. The important date is tomorrow for the last of the presentations. And then September 13th is when the board will be making decisions on what to fund.
So tomorrow are the presentations. The application process is finished.
Right.
So these are the presentations.
Right. And then next week, the board will be giving me direction as to what give me a sense of what projects they would like to fund. And then it's finalized a month later on September 13th.
So I'm seeing here that a description of some of the reasons people are, the cities are asking for money. Story City is wants to improve the North Park project.
Yeah, that's a really exciting project. Well, they mm-hmm. all are, but this is really...
That's the park with the little bridge in it?
That's the northern one. That's the southern one. The north one is the one with the historic carousel.
Okay.
And that's such a unique gem to Story City and Story County and Iowa in total. It's a project that builds on the value of the carousel. It continues a momentum that Story City has done with improvements, like you said, to the South Park with the bridge. It builds a trail system that's accessible for all ages, does improvements, adds a wall for movies, mm-hmm. to be able to show movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really nice project.
And in Collins, it says it's the demolition and revitalization of buildings along Main Street, so they're revitalizing their Main Street area.
They are. They have two projects that are separate yet tied together. They have one building right next to the community center that is a very vibrant community center, really the heart of Collins, that they would like to remove. So that's the demolition piece. And then put in a park space, a gathering space in that lot, vacant lot. And then just a door or two doors down in another building, they would like to revitalize that building and then use it for a potential lease for a business to come to town to. So both are engaging pieces of downtown to help out the Main Street of Collins.
Mm-hmm. And Huxley wants to build an all-inclusive playground structure.
Yep, at the Nordkalsen Park, Huxley is continuing their momentum to really build their park system. They have a great park system under great leadership down there to really make their system accessible for all ages, all abilities, and that's what this project does. Huxley was funded last year as
mm-hmm.
well,
mm-hmm.
So it's again a continuation of their programming they have going.
So are all these projects slated to be funded, or are they being considered?
They're being considered at
uh-huh.
this point.
And they're all projects that are in the anywhere from, this is a, is this a million? 900?
Yep.
Wow.
City of Cambridge.
These are big
doing,
projects.
Yeah, City of Cambridge is doing a community center, and that is initial project budget is about $1.9 million.
So these are large grants. And tell me again where the money comes from.
The money comes from the wind turbines throughout Story County and Vetter equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So what just a tax increment financing as simplest point, the County Board of Supervisors set a base value, assessed value of those properties, the wind turbines and Vetter equipment, and then the incremental taxes from that property goes directly to Story County as a taxing entity rather than the other taxing entities. With one exception, the county's policy is that they will only take 50% of that incremental financing. So it's not the whole 100%. So a wind turbine, if it starts generating taxes at $1,000, it starts at zero and then to $1,000, Story County will take a maximum of $500.
And where does the other 50% go?
It remains with the taxing entities.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Which is a policy decision the Board of Supervisors chose to take.
What is a taxing entity?
Your school districts,
mm-hmm.
Your cities, the Des Moines Area Community College, those that levy taxes
mm-hmm.
as part of our property tax system. Those are
so,
the taxing entities.
So kind of the usual mm-hmm. things that taxes go to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's very interesting. And then the other half goes to special projects that
right.
Obviously are used to revitalize and enhance what looks like mostly the smaller towns in Story County.
It has been. Throughout the process, we've started this in 2011 with Dakin's Lake improvements and paving a road along 590th and the bike trail along Indian Creek south of Nevada. Following that, in 2012, we started these community projects. Every community except for Colo and Gilbert has had a project.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has been really spread out. And it's been exciting and a great opportunity for me to be able to work with these communities and
yeah.
see what, even just a smaller amount could do for the communities.
Yeah. Now, the total funds requested here is about $2.5 million. About how much money is there actually?
Well, that's the total project funds, that about $2.5 million. What we have requested is a little under $370,000.
So how much money is there actually available?
That's what we'll find out tomorrow from the county auditor.
Uh-huh. You don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. I have a ballpark figure that's within the range of what the requests are. But a month or so ago, the County Board of Supervisors approved a bond to help pay for the financing, the Iowa State Research Park, the Conservation Park. And so that's going to be paid off with this funding mechanism as well. And so the County Auditor's Office tomorrow will present to the board what really is in the forecast for available funds for the projects.
Okay, that's very interesting. Thank you for it's a, I see here that the cities also match the money.
The policies require a minimum, or suggest, require may be too strong of a word. As the board says, they'd like to see the communities have some skin in the game, at least 25%. Mm-hmm. And if you look at all the requests except for Story City, they definitely have the 25%. Story City is kind of a flip side. The counties, if it were to be a funding partner, would be 25%.
Mm-hmm.
And the community is putting up the remainder.
Mm-hmm. So do these requests generally come from the city councils, from these cities?
The city councils, and we have school districts that apply too. Colonesco School District applied 3 years in a row for playground equipment up in their site up by Dakin's Lake.
Okay. Leanne, any other things you want to tell us before we wrap up the show? Give us some other information.
I do. We have some upcoming conservation programs that I encourage everyone, any age, any ability, take advantage of the educational and outreach programming through Story County Conservation. They, no matter what program you go to, they're exciting and engaging. We have an evening prairie walk coming up on Thursday, August 25th, and Wild Tots, which is for ages 2 to 4 and a parent or an adult, is August 27th. And then Clay Play, which is going to be really fun, hands-on, looking for banks of natural clay during a creek walk, is coming up on August 27th as well. All those, you go to Story County Conservation to register.
StoryCountyConservation.org.
Yep.
.gov or .org?
I think they are .org.
Okay. StoryCountyConservation.org.
Yeah. And there's online registration. It's a very exciting, as I said, exciting, engaging programs no matter your age or ability. And the 20th anniversary of the Partners Fall Festival is coming up later on in September. So if you've never attended a Partners Fall Festival, it's a great time. It's actually October 2nd.
Okay. So when you come back in September, we have to be sure to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then just a plug, the supermarket for Veterans Benefits is coming up. Not until November yet, but we like to get the word out.
Okay.
That's an opportunity of vets to come together and learn the opportunities they have and the support system they have in Story County, and that will be on Friday, November 18th. And, of course, it's that time of year. I need to remind everyone that taxes are due starting in September. During the month of September, becomes a very busy office over at the administration building in Story County at the treasurer's office. And then along with that, county offices are closed on Monday, September 5th for Labor Day.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And we've been hearing from Leanne Harder, Story County Outreach and Special Projects Manager. Thank you, Leanne.
Thank you.
And we'll see you again at the beginning of September. And we can go over some of those last ones then, those last events. Earlier in the show, you heard from a former prosecuting attorney, Fred Liu, who practices restorative justice, a transformative form of helping both criminals and their victims and reducing crime. Also, Julie Weeks, director of Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, and Dan DeGeest from the Ames Bicycle Coalition, introduced new bike share programs that are springing up in Ames. Local Talk is on at KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. And you can also listen to entire show and past Local Talk shows on our website, khoifm.org, where you'll also find information about the people you heard today and contact information. Local Talk was engineered today by Jonah DeGeest, and our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Swimming to the Other Side by Emma's Revolution and Mellow Yellow by Donovan. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. And be sure to join us on Saturday, this coming Saturday, the 13th, for our birthday party here at KHOI 410 Douglas Avenue in Ames from 11 a.m. till 9 p.m. Book sale, basketball playing, blueberry pies, and barbecue. Please come and join us and buy a book, play some basketball, and wish us happy birthday and have some pie. Thank you for listening today on the radio, and we will see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.